Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. That's not the usual music, is it? Nope, that's the Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin music. We've got Jimmy with us this hour, and lots of weird questions collected up for him. And we are live. We are not pre-recorded. I think people might be tempted to think, oh, this is some kind of pre-recorded show. But it's not. We're live. We just don't have a call screener today. So Jimmy was kind enough to get out a whole bunch of his collection of weird questions and share them with us today so that we could have a show. And Jimmy Akin, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. The book to get if you're maybe starting out thinking, I'd like to do a little bit of this apologetic stuff. Get that book and you get all these hundreds and hundreds of answers to just all the basic questions and far many beyond the basic questions you'll get if you want to explain and defend the Catholic faith. Also, Jimmy's the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, which you can find at Mysterious FM. And tomorrow has a show about an extraordinary miracle involving the regrowing of a limb. I don't think you're going to want to miss this
one. Or the reappearance of a limb anyway.
Oh, reappearance. Oh, yeah, that's right. You got to be careful how you say that. Yeah, the reappearance of a limb that had been amputated. So check it out at mysterious.fm. Weird questions. I'll tell you what, here's the rules. Jimmy gets a whole bunch of weird questions and he takes them all seriously. He treats every single one of them with respect. And we have a lot of fun learning new and interesting things. I am still gobsmacked by the last answer of the last hour. 1.2%, amazing. Here's a question for you, Jimmy. Tamara asks this, why does Italy have a witch character in their Christmas holiday tradition?
Well, you know, the basic answer is that's just how Italian culture grew up. Now, a lot of people, because we don't have a witch in our Christmas tradition here in the United States, they may not be familiar with this. So I'll give you a little bit of background on it. The witch's name is Befana. And if you Google Befana, a bunch of stuff will come up. Wikipedia has an article that describes the custom and so forth. The name Befana may come from Epiphania, because you can hear how they sound the same, and the B sound is a bilabial. Both the B sound and the P sound are bilabial plosives, and so P and B tend to convert into each other pretty freely. Like, for example, Arabic has no P sound. And so when Arabic speakers learn how to speak English, it's really hard for them to say, please.
Oh, because
so
they haven't
instead,
done it.
Because they don't have that sound. And so they'll substitute a B and say, please. And because they do have a B sound. So anyway, P and B are pretty freely convertible. And so Befania may come from Epiphania, because the witch arrives on the eve of the feast of Epiphany. So, you know, Epiphany is January 6th, so Befana shows up on the evening of January 5th. She is regarded as a good witch, just like Glinda, the good witch of the South in the Wizard of Oz. And she gives gifts of candy. She gives gifts or candy to children if they're good. If they're bad, she gives them coal or just a stick or black candy. just like with Santa Claus, people may leave stuff out for Befana, although it's a little more adult than what Santa typically gets. You know, milk and cookies. The Befana gets wine or food.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is just part of Italian Christmas traditions. And in fact, I looked up a papal angelus where the Pope himself gave greetings to the Viva la Befana, or Long Live the Befana, folkloric procession participants. They were having a folkloric procession, you know, celebrating the Befana figure, and even in his papal angelus, the Pope gave them his greetings.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, when they
because
the different groups gathered.
Yeah. This isn't a real witch, folks. It's all pretend. And the church is not a prude about pretend stuff like this.
Thank goodness for that. Thank you very much for the question, too. Oh, wait, I got to remember who that was. That was Tamara. Tamara, thank you very much for the question. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, and Kate wants to know this. Could clairvoyance be a natural ability we don't yet understand?
Okay, so the first thing I need to do is talk about what clairvoyance is. It comes from French roots. Clair means clear, and voyance means seeing. So from its roots, clairvoyance would mean clear seeing. But it's actually changed meaning over time. In the 100 years ago, anybody who did anything psychic was often called a clairvoyant. So if you're getting information telepathically, oh, you're a clairvoyant. Or if you're getting information about the future, oh, you're a clairvoyant. Or if you're getting information about a distant location, oh, you're a clairvoyant. So anyone who did anything psychic was called a clairvoyant, you know, in the 1800s. But the term has now become more specific. Clairvoyance involves getting information about a distant or hidden location or object. So it's something you can't perceive with your natural senses. It's real time. It's not about the future or the past. You're not getting the information from another mind, so it's not telepathy. You're apparently, at least this is the claim, getting the information directly from a remote or hidden place. And there's been a lot of research done on this. A lot of research was done in the 1970s at Stanford Research Institute, or SRI. There was also research done at SAIC, which is another government think tank research facility. And the CIA and the Defense Department had a program. In fact, there's actually more than one program, but the famous one became known as Stargate. And it went on from the 1970s to the mid-1990s. And they reported getting good results. Now, I should mention, because if people look up a particular section in the Catechism, I forget the number, but the word clairvoyance is mentioned in the English edition of the Catechism, where it cautions against clairvoyance. But here's the deal. I looked it up in the original, in the original French, which was the language that the catechism was written in, and the word in French is voyance. But voyance does not mean clairvoyance. This is a mistranslation. Voyance refers to fortune telling. So what the catechism is actually doing is cautioning people against fortune telling as a method falsely supposed to unveil the future. Well, clairvoyance doesn't have anything to do with the future. At least, you know, it's trying to get real-time information about a location. And also, the catechism is dealing with folk phenomena, not with scientific research. So we're really talking about two different domains. The catechism is not condemning scientific research into areas like this. So could clairvoyance, understood in this sense, be a human ability that's natural that we don't yet understand? Well, in clairvoyance experiments, also called remote viewing or remote perception experiments, people are not invoking spirits. They're not calling upon spirits. And it just seems to be the person himself who is involved, who's doing the remote viewing. And Occam's razor from our best medieval bud William of Ockham, when it comes to theory discernment in scientific matters, says don't multiply entities beyond what you need to explain the data. So if it appears to just be the person and there are no spirits being invoked and we don't have any evidence of spirits around, then assume it's just the person. In other words, assume this is a natural ability of the human mind if it's real. And that is, in fact, the assumption that parapsychologists make. They assume that as a general matter, psychic abilities, including clairvoyance, would be natural human abilities. They're not as reliable as some other human abilities. They're not as powerful as some other human abilities. But that's not surprising because, you know, like we have humans are visually oriented animals compared to dogs. You know, dogs are olfactory or scent oriented animals. Their sense of smell is a lot better than ours. Humans get most of our information visually. We're visually oriented creatures. And so consequently, our sense of smell is weak and unreliable compared to the sense of smell a dog has. But our vision is way better than a dog's. Well, it could be in addition to weak, unreliable senses like smell or taste, we may have other weak or unreliable ways of getting information about the world, and psychic functioning, the theory goes, could be part of that. And there has been speculation on this by Catholics who've done work in parapsychology, like the, I want to say, Cistercian abbot Alois Weisinger, who was a parapsychologist in the late 19th and early 20th century. He speculated that psychic functions like clairvoyance may be remnants of the preternatural gifts that our first parents, Adam and Eve, would have had. And that, because it's a common theme in a lot of especially medieval Catholic thought, that Adam and Eve basically had superpowers before the fall, mm-hmm. and then they lost them when they fell. And it could be, Weisinger speculates, that what we think of as psychic functions are the remnants of those preternatural abilities or preternatural gifts, only they don't work the way they should because of the fall. And so they're weak and unreliable now, whereas they would have been strong and reliable for Adam and Eve. And if they exist, then we may suppose they might be strong and reliable for us in the resurrection. Ah. When we get our superpowers back.
Thank you very much, Kate. Appreciate the question. That brings us to the break. Right back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
At EWTN Radio, your family. And because you're a part of our family, we value your opinions on what you hear on EWTN. You can call our listener comment line 24/7 at 205-795-5773. We value your comments, your questions, and any suggestions you may have to make EWTN Radio even better. 205-795-5773. And thank you for listening to EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin's our guest. It's weird questions this hour. And lots of here's a weird one from Justine, one that I have a personal interest in because, well, I'll tell you why after. I have a student, Justine says, I have a student who is convinced that Maine does not exist. The entire state of Maine! Exclamation point. How do we prove its existence aside from taking a trip up north?
Well, there was a time before Maine existed. I mean, Maine and Rhode Island used to be part of Massachusetts, right? Cy Kellett, native of Massachusetts?
That is correct. Well, Rhode Island would have been very, very long ago. But yeah, Maine was, even at the time of the Revolution, part of Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. So, and then there was the time before even Massachusetts existed, before European colonization. Okay. This question reminds me of the song "There Is No Arizona." It's a country song about it's like a woman whose husband has left to go to Arizona, but she later becomes convinced that non-literally there is no Arizona, meaning her husband has just run off and dumped her.
Oh,
so yeah. If you've got a student, Justine, that literally believes there's no state of Maine, my first thought would be he's joking and he's just yanking your chain by making this claim. If he's not, my second thought is he's got some kind of mental illness that he should probably get treatment for, because this would be a serious delusion if he sincerely believes this. In terms of how to prove it to him, well, assuming it's not mental illness and that it doesn't need a mental illness treatment, one way would be showing him maps. And showing him, you know, look, this map is approved by the U.S. Geological Survey or whatever. And, you know, unless you've got evidence of some giant conspiracy involving map-making companies, then you ought to trust this map. And And so if he still persists, say, what's your evidence for a giant conspiracy? Another step beyond that is you could video conference with people who are in the state of Maine or from the state of Maine, and you could allow him to choose unexpected people to call, you know, so that you have no way of setting it up. You know what, you don't know these people, you don't know what they're going to say, but if you can contact someone whose address is in Maine and he can ask them, so where do you live, what state do you live in, and they say Maine, well, that would be evidence that Maine is real. Failing that, you could take him to Maine and show him all the signs that say Maine, you know, for different places. You can take him to Bangor and Bar Harbor and all those places up there, and let him interview people and look at the signage all over everything. But that still might not convince him, because he could propose it's all an elaborate hoax. But if after doing all that he still thinks Maine is an elaborate hoax, then I would suggest he really is probably going to need some mental help.
Either that or a
serious epistemic intervention.
Yes. I don't know how to do an epistemic intervention, but I think he needs one. Because we're going to Maine on the cruise. We're not talking about CatholicAnswersCruise.com. We're not talking about that anymore. But so on July...
I went on one of those once, and we went to Bar Harbor, and the tide was low, and I got to walk across the entire bar at Bar Harbor. It's a stone.
Oh yeah,
it's an underwater stone, not ramp, but it's a natural formation that forms a bar made out of stones under the harbor at Bar Harbor, and I walked all the way across it and back and encountered some bees that I didn't want to encounter, but they didn't sting me, so that was okay.
How long does it stay exposed? Like, you're not out there like, oh, I better get back fast, are you? Or
No, tide was down.
CatholicAnswersCruise.com. Maybe the student should come, Justine. Maybe the student should book passage on the cruise, and we'll show Maine to him or her. Ted wants to know this. A podcast on the couple featured in the movie The Conjuring. Are they really church-approved exorcists? Is the movie based on real events? It's right up there with The Exorcist as far as scary movies go for me. Love your work, Jimmy Akin, on Catholic Answers and Mysterious World. Your knowledge and intelligence amaze me.
Well, Ted, so the couple you're referring to are Ed and Lorraine Warren, and they both passed on to their wards now. I do plan on covering them with a full episode on Mysterious World later, so I will get around to that. But haven't done full research on them yet. The movie The Conjuring is allegedly based on real events, if memory serves correctly. In terms of Ed and Lorraine Warren themselves, they were not exorcists. You, in order to be an exorcist in the Catholic Church, you have to be a priest who's been given a special commission by the bishop, and neither one of them were priests because they were a married couple. Ed portrayed himself as a demonologist, which is someone who knows about demons but is not an official exorcist. And Lorraine portrayed herself at various times as a psychic medium, which is somewhat problematic, not the psychic part, but the medium part. They may, though, have had some involvement in actual exorcisms, because exorcists pull in different people to help them out with their work. So if they think someone's a competent demonologist, they may pull them in. Even if they think someone's a psychic, they may pull them in. Father Gabriel Amorth, who is sometimes wrongly billed as the official exorcist of Rome, or the Vatican's exorcist. He wasn't either one of those things. He was an exorcist in the Diocese of Rome. He did not work for the Vatican. He was not the only exorcist in the Diocese of Rome, but he's the famous one. Father Gabriel Amorth used psychics in his investigation of cases of demonic involvement. In Italy, they call them sensitives. That's what they call psychics in Italy. But he would use sensitives or psychics in his cases if he thought they could genuinely help. When it comes, so Ed and Lorraine Warren may have had some involvement in exorcisms that were authorized. They also may have had involvement in exorcisms that were not authorized. I have to say, based on the what I have researched about them, I think they were gullible. For example, they were taken in by the Amityville Horror, which was about a demonic infestation in a house. And there was even a famous book and movie that were made about it. But it turns out the Amityville Horror was all made up. But that didn't stop the Warrens. They thought it was real. So I think that at a minimum, they made a mistake, but I really suspect they were kind of gullible. I also have evidence of criminal activity on their parts. And my preliminary look at the evidence indicates possible fakery throughout significant portions of their career. So I do not trust what Ed and Lorraine Warren would claim. I would want independent verification of stuff. And I'll do further research and eventually do a mysterious world on them.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the question. Appreciate that, Ted. This next one comes from Justin, and he wants to know about Elon Musk. Elon Musk just unveiled his Neuralink program. The idea is to allow human beings to reach the next stage in their evolution, be able to keep up with the singularity, and more importantly, keep up with artificial intelligence. Many people are afraid this is ushering in the end times or is an attack on the authentic dignity of the human person. Other people think it's just the next logical step in human evolution or technological evolution. How do we understand this technology and its implications for humanity? Some people have even noted that the language they use is messianic in its couching. The blind will see and the lame will walk, etc.
Well, okay, it's sort of contrary to pious sensibilities to use language like that, but it calls attention to what Neuralink is being proposed to do in the short term, which is help people who have disabilities like blindness or who are paraplegic and can't walk and can't control objects in their environment. And so the idea, at least in the short term, is to help restore function by creating a neural interface to connect their brain to computer systems. And this has nothing to do with the end times. That there's nothing in biblical prophecy about brain computer interfaces. There's nothing in the Bible about computers or high technology or brain interfaces. There's just nothing like that. So this has nothing to do with the end times from a biblical evidence point of view. When it comes to offended human dignity, well, we've already got, there's nothing sacred about your skull. You can put things through the skull. You can do brain surgery on someone and remove a tumor to help them out. You know, that involves opening up the head and doing stuff in there. We currently have, they don't connect to computer systems, but even apart from Neuralink, we've had implantable devices for the brain that help people with disabilities. For example, with deafness, there's what's known as a cochlear implant, where you implant a device in the head that helps the person have some representation of sound in their head. It's not as good as natural human hearing, but it's better than nothing. And the church hadn't had a problem with that. So the immediate goal for this kind of technology is to overcome handicaps, and that's fine as long as it is done safely. Now, given that, could you use it to do other things, like connect you to the internet so you could do research or store files or things like that? In other words, could you have what John Scalzi wrote in his novel, referred to in his novel Old Man's War, what he called a brain pal, a little computer device that assists your brain? Could you do that? Well, sure, as long as there are sufficient returns, you know, benefits that it provides, and so long as it's safe. However, safety factors, both biological and otherwise, including brain security, must be taken seriously. But if those are taken care of and the risks are acceptable given the benefits, there wouldn't be any reason you couldn't in principle use it. There also, though, would need to be attention to the effects of this on society, because one thing that the church has been concerned about is the creation of a technological overclass where some people have either economic or technological advantages that other people are completely left out of. So you develop a sort of two-tiered society, like in the movie Gattaca, where you have the haves and the have-nots. And the church has concern for all human beings. So just like the internet became popularized to where even people in third world countries have the internet now, they wouldn't want to see rich people in the first world monopolize the brain pals.
Hey, thanks very much, Justin, for that question. It's Weird Questions for Jimmy Akin. Lots more to come right after this on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
As we read the Gospels, every Christian faces the question again and again, what does Jesus mean? Getting the answer right is critical to both growth in holiness and fruitful evangelization. Want to know Jesus better so you can introduce him to your friends? Then it's time to get serious about understanding his words. Why not join Catholic Answers for our 10th annual Apologetics Conference? Learn from me the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ. September 26th through 29th, right here in sunny San Diego. Learn from our guests, Dr. Scott Hahn and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, Father Sebastian Walsh, Billy Junker, Father Paul Check, and, of course, all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. It'll be 4 days of fun, faith, fellowship, and a live radio show. Seats are still available, but going fast, visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it's Weird Questions for Jimmy Akin. Lots and lots of weird questions lined up. We got a whole bunch. I wish I had thought of it before. I heard something about Scarlett Johansson's voice in AI, and I don't know anything about it. And if I had prepared, I could have asked you about it, Jimmy, but I don't know what it was. Did you hear anybody hear about this? Scarlett Johansson is going to sue somebody? Some AI company was using her voice. Amanda asks this, where did the story of the little drummer boy visiting baby Jesus come from? Were drummer boys really a thing back then? That's a great question. Did shepherds use drums to herd sheep? Awesome, Amanda.
Okay, so the song, and its official title is Carol of the Drum, but everybody knows it as The Little Drummer Boy.
Oh, yeah.
Was written by American composer Catherine Kennicott Davis in 1941. So it's about 80 years old. And apparently the melody drove the lyrics and the story. So they had this melody with the pa-rumpa-pom-poms in it. And she came up with this story about a drummer boy to fit with that melody and wrote lyrics based on that. Some have speculated that this song is based on an earlier Czech carol, meaning from the Czech Republic. But that seems to be uncertain. Drummer boys were a thing in the past, and you know we still have drummer boys today as part of marching bands, for example, but they were a thing in the past, and they actually had practical uses. For example, during the Civil War, drummer boys were used on the battlefield, and they were not typically they typically were children. They were not as old as the men who were fighting. And I remember one story about a particular drummer boy who was part of Confederate forces, who, because of his physical size, had short legs, and he could not keep up with the men as they were marching. Now, the men themselves would not have had long legs by modern standards. People back at the time of the Civil War were short by modern standards because of the nutrition they had available. And I remember going once to a museum in New Orleans and just marveling at the size of the uniforms for full-grown men. They were like children's uniforms to me. Wow. And so this drummer boy would have had even shorter legs. And so the men go marching down the road. The little drummer boy can't keep up with them, so he would fall behind. And eventually, though, when the men would stop to rest, the drummer boy would catch up with them. So they always knew he's just late because he can't keep up, and he'll be here eventually. Well, one day this had happened. He had fallen behind. He couldn't see any of the troops in front of him. And all of a sudden, he hears a group of Yankees coming up behind him. And so he gets off the road and hides in the woods alongside the road. And he knows if the Yankees catch up, they're going to go past where he was, and they're going to encounter his own troops up ahead. So he thinks, what can I do? And the Yankees can't see him. He's safe, but his comrades are not. And so he thinks, what can I do? And he decides, he waits until the Yankees gets up to where he's hiding in the woods, and he takes his drum and he plays the long roll, which is a particular rhythm pattern. This is what they would do. They would communicate orders to troops in the field, because they didn't have broadcast systems. They didn't have walkie-talkies. They would use the drummer boy to play particular rhythms to communicate orders to the soldiers over a distance. So he plays the long roll, which means get ready to fire. And so the Yankees thought, there are a bunch of Confederate soldiers hiring in the woods, and they've just got the order to fire. They immediately retreated and went the other way.
So, nice.
So yeah, drummer boys historically are a thing. Drums have been around since the Stone Age. And, you know, they may have been used with sheep. I don't know that they were, but we have I'm pretty sure, given how common drums are, they've been used at some point. I know we have evidence for the use of flutes with sheep. In fact, if you look on some editions of the Catechism, there's actually a picture of a shepherd playing a flute and a sheep listening, because sheep do that. And this is a symbol of Christ and his follower. So I know flutes have been used with sheep. I'm pretty sure drums have too, although I don't have specific evidence for that. But especially, you know, you have children who are often assigned to watch sheep because it's not the most demanding task in the world. And so you had like the three shepherd children at Fatima, for example. Well, okay, boys, teenage boys and younger, will tap out rhythms to entertain themselves even without drums, including boys like Cy Kellett, who taps with his fingers rhythms on the desk in front of him, not on the air, but during the break. In fact, he was doing it during the break we just came back from. So given that human tendency of people with a Y chromosome, I have no doubt that there were boys watching sheep who, to alleviate the boredom, would drum.
And thank you very much, Amanda, for that. Thank you very much. And I do. I can't. The reason I don't do it on the air is because Darren will yell at me if I do.
Of course, he'd cut your hands off.
He'd be like, "Stop!"
And rightly so.
But I do. Actually, I said I don't do. But I occasionally Darren does have to yell at me about it. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Teresa's question. Teresa, everybody's been wanting to know this. Did they really find Goliath's body on Golgotha?
No, they did not. Goliath's body has not been found. And the idea that Goliath's body would be connected with Golgotha is, so Golgotha is the hill in Jerusalem where Jesus was covered. It was crucified. It means the place of the skull. And the idea that Goliath would be connected with Golgotha is probably based on the similarity of names. They both have G's, they both have O's, they both have medial L's, meaning in the middle of the word. They both have an aspirated T, you know, the th sound, close to the at or close to the end of the word. So they sound similar, and that's probably why people got that the idea. But historically, that would make absolutely no sense. Because at the time that that Goliath lived, he was a Philistine, and the Philistines lived down by the coast of Israel. Jerusalem, which at the time was in Jebusite hands, not Philistine hands, was up in the hilly region. And so Goliath, when he died after David killed him and cut off his head, would have been buried in Philistia, down by the coast, not up in Jerusalem, which was a Jebusite land or Jebusite city, which was later conquered by David, who made it his capital.
All right. How about this one, Jimmy? Thank you, Teresa, for that question. Therese, for that question. James wants to know this. After the final judgment, what purpose does hell serve?
Well, we're not sure, because God hadn't really told us where hell is going to be spatially after the final judgment. So that's a wide open topic. But wherever it is, and it's really more of a condition, according to John Paul II, than a specific place, it's the condition of being in separation from God. And that's what the people who will be in hell chose. They chose to reject love, which is to say to reject God, who is love, according to John. And so they will and God will honor their choice, which means they'll spend eternity in frustration without love. So hell, to the extent we conceptualize it as a concrete thing, well, its purpose is given the people what they chose. They chose this life without love, and now they're getting it. So that's its purpose. It's to give people what they chose. It also, to the extent it's a physical place, it gives the lost somewhere to be and helps keep them in existence so that they can receive what they chose. Even though they have definitively excluded themselves from the source of goodness and joy, which is God.
James, thank you very much. We're going to take a quick break. Here's a little tease for you. The next question is about the game Twister. That's right, Twister. Right back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. St. Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
Listen to EWTN, you know, listen to the Catholic stations, but turn away that mainstream media, that mainstream news. It's all nonsense.
I come from a family of 16. I was really encouraged when I was listening to your radio station, and I just think everything you were saying was absolutely true, and that there's still hope out there.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. There's the music for a Weird Questions show. It's special music we have for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. And so since Darren played the music, let's just keep doing Weird Questions for Jimmy Akin. This one comes from Miles, and it's about the game Twister. Is it true that the game Twister was invented to help Masons practice their handshakes?
I haven't been able to find anyone else who makes this claim, but I'm pretty darn sure it is absolutely not true. Twister was invented in 1966 by a couple of people. One of them was a guy named Charles Foley, who had the idea of using people as playing pieces in a game. There also were two other guys, Reynolds Geyer and Neil Rabens, who came up with the Twister mat for the people to play on. You know, there have been attempts to use humans like as chess pieces and stuff, but here they got the idea to have a mat with these colored circles on it that people would have to put a hand or a foot on. And so then they came up with a way to randomize where people had to move their hands and their feet. You know, you used to like spin a dial and it's right foot red or whatever. Got to get your right foot over onto a red circle. The game was originally called Pretzel because you're kind of human pretzels in this game. There doesn't appear to be any known connection to masonry, and there is no use of handshakes in the game. The goal is not to shake anybody's hand. The goal is to get either your foot or your hand onto the right colored circle flat, preferably. You're not shaking hands with another human being. So the idea that it was invented to help Masons practice handshakes when handshakes aren't even part of the game would not be credible. And I hope that helps. One more Masonic conspiracy theory put to rest.
I mean, if it's a conspiracy,
by simple logic,
it's like, yeah, right. There's no handshake, but there's some conspiracies that aren't evil. If you have a conspiracy to invent a board game, I mean, that's not really a kind of a, it's a mat game. I mean, that's not exactly evil.
Well, but it's also not a conspiracy because a conspiracy by definition is an agreement between two or more people to do something illegal.
Oh, yeah.
And you're not doing anything illegal by playing a game.
All right. Nice try, Miles. Nice try. Rob wants to know this. Would the just war doctrine apply for humanity if aliens attacked, or would we treat them like parasites?
Well, it's going to depend on the extent to which aliens are rational, sentient beings. If they are both rational and sentient, then we need to treat them like other human beings who are rational, sentient. We need to treat them like human beings who are also rational and sentient. And so the just war doctrine would apply to them. On the other hand, to the extent they are not rational or not sentient, then we could treat them like animals or natural disasters, and just war would not apply to them. So it's going to depend on the aliens we meet. Are they rational? And are they sentient? That's going to give you the answer.
We already know how they're going to attack. They're going to throw asteroids at us because Jimmy gave them that idea.
Well, that's one way they could attack.
I don't know. I just wouldn't, especially when we're on the radio, because these are beaming out there into space. Don't give them ideas, Jimmy. Don't come up with ideas for the aliens.
You know, on Coast to Coast AM, the old Art Bell show, they may still have him for all I know, but they had a weekend host like on Saturday nights named Ian Punnett.
Oh, yeah.
And Ian Punnett he was a good interviewer. I liked listening to him. But he would begin his shows with a kind of pre-written statement. And part of the pre-written statement was, and to all the alien ships waiting in orbit, hiding behind their invisibility shields, please remember, when you invade, eat the Canadians first.
Now there, see, that's a helpful message. That's the kind of thing we want to put out there. Miguel wants to know this. And all right, this is a good, important question. Jimmy Akin, what about this one? That's how he begins. If a UFO piloted by time-traveling aliens with psychic abilities appeared over Vatican City, claiming to have influenced biblical events, how would the Catholic Church verify or contest their claims?
Well, if this really happened, and that's a really big if, but if it happened, that they showed up and made these claims, the Vatican would not automatically reject them and say, oh, that's impossible, because there are lots of influences on biblical events that we don't know a lot about or anything about. A lot of information, you know, as they say in Lord of the Rings, so much has been lost about the past. And so, however, so even though the Vatican wouldn't automatically reject these claims, there would be skepticism. I mean, you don't believe people just because they have high tech. You know, if you go to a, you know, high tech store, you don't believe everything that the clerk tells you. They just because they have high tech, they can still be liars. And furthermore, these aliens, if they're smart enough to get here, to fling themselves between the stars, they probably have the same predatory background we do. Because you don't need intelligence to sneak up on a blade of grass, as Larry Niven pointed out. You need intelligence to catch prey. And so any aliens that have the intelligence to get here probably are either omnivores or carnivores. And that means they have a predatory background, and that means they're likely to have the same ability to lie and deceive in order to capture prey. So what would the Vatican want to do if they're making these claims? Well, show us how the tech works and let us use it to go back in time to verify whether you had any involvement or not. Now, in doing that, we would need to carefully distinguish between things that would undermine the faith and things that would not. For example, it says that at the time of the Exodus, God sent a wind to part the Reed Sea. In English, we often say Red Sea, but it's really the Reed Sea, different seas. You know, it doesn't say God telekinetically pushed the waters apart. It says he sent a wind specifically. So if the aliens, you know, we go back in time and we see, oh, there's an alien ship in the sky and it's got an enormous wind generator. You know, it's got a big fan or jet engine that's blowing or something and that pushes the water apart. Well, okay, the Bible only says that God sent a wind and maybe he used the angels, the aliens to do it. In that case, that wouldn't contradict the faith. On the other hand, second example, let's suppose the aliens claimed that they brought Jesus back from the dead by teleporting into the tomb and then using an adrenaline shot and defibrillators to restart his heart and get it back into a normal sinus rhythm. Okay, well, in that case, Jesus would have been raised from the dead by purely natural means. Not by the power of God, not miraculously. And so that kind of thing would have a tendency to undermine the faith. And so the church would be much less open to the claim that aliens resurrected Jesus using medical technology than they would have a big problem with that compared to, oh, the aliens were the source of the wind that the Bible mentions as part in the Red Sea.
I gotcha. Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, Miguel, thanks very much for the question. Let's go to Brian's question. It's weird questions for Jimmy Akin, and here's Brian's. God uses the physical. So will God use technology to bring about his kingdom, such as the resurrection? Will there be technology in heaven?
Well, to quote a man who at least had a very insightful moment at one point, why does God need a starship? You know,
Star Trek 6. Is that 6?
Nope. Oh, 5.
Off by one. All right.
Star Trek 5, The Search for God. And so, you know, because that's how it goes. Star Trek 3 is The Search for Spock. Star Trek 4 is The Search for Whales. Star Trek 5 is The Search for God. And Star Trek 6 is The Search for Peace. They're all these search movies. So, you know, they have in Star Trek V an entity that claims to be God, but he wants to use the Enterprise, and Kirk has the line, why does God need a starship? Which is very insightful. Unfortunately, a lot of the script is terrible, but that's an insightful moment. Well, the resurrection of the dead is not going to involve technology. Just like aliens didn't restart Jesus's heart using technology, God is not going to restart or recombine us into existence using technology. So there's no essential connection between technology and the eschaton or the final things. We have hints that we will be in a state where we don't need technology. In fact, according to various speculations, we're going to have superpowers. So we may not need it because we have all of our needs taken care of through these superpowers God has given us. Like, there's a passage in Paul in Romans 15 where Paul says the stomach is made for food and food is made for the stomach, but God will destroy them both, suggesting we may not eat in the new order of creation. And Jesus indicates we're not going to get married because we're going to be immortal like the angels. We won't need to replace members of our species because they won't be dying. So that immortality, that's another superpower. So we may not need technology because of our enhanced upgraded abilities, but we may still be able to use it just as creatures. You know, is just because we may not need it doesn't mean we may not use it. So it's possible that there will be a role for it, but if so, it has not been disclosed to us.
Ah, thank you, Brian. Maybe we could play Tetris, just be really good at Tetris with those superpowers. This was from Curtis. It says
RCS Curtis.
All right, RCS Curtis. Is it possible to give the Pope a different diocese than that of Rome? What if in the future the Vatican had to be moved off-world? Nuclear war, alien invasion, genocide against Catholics, etc.?
Well, this is a matter of speculation, not church teaching, but I would say the answer is yes. The Pope could hypothetically move the Diocese of Rome to another diocese, or move his headquarters to another diocese. And the reason I say that is that's already happened. It happened in the New Testament. Peter was not originally based in Rome. It wasn't until Herod Agrippa tried to have him executed that he left Jerusalem. So originally, Peter was based in Jerusalem, and later he went to Rome. So if the Pope has the abilities that Peter has as his successor, then if he became permanently unable to be based in Rome, he could go to New Rome or somewhere else. In fact, there's even a parallel that kind of – there's something that kind of parallels this in the Middle Ages, where even though the Pope was still officially the Bishop of Rome – for several generations, they were living in Avignon, France. This is a period known as the Avignon Papacy. Now, eventually, they reestablished residency in Rome, but I would say using his papal authority, hypothetically, the Avignon popes could have relocated their headquarters permanently to Avignon rather than Rome, just like Peter relocated his from Jerusalem to Rome. So I think that's possible in principle.
I'm going to see if I can get one more in here. Thank you for that question. Adam wants to know this. When someone passes away, does their guardian angel get transferred to someone else?
The answer is a definite maybe. We don't know. It's possible that their guardian angel gets a transfer. It's possible also that a guardian angel may be guarding more than one person at a time. What God guarantees is that our guardian is sufficient for our needs. But angels, because like I said, we don't know their limits, they may be capable of sufficiently guarding multiple people at once. It's also possible, just to go in a different direction, that maybe they have multiple transfers during this life. You know, what God guarantees is we're going to have adequate angelic security. Doesn't mean it's going to be the same security officer for our entire life. He may have a rotation going. So, you know, the church really doesn't have a teaching in this area, and we can speculate about it, but we can't really be definite. What we can be definite about is God will make sure we have the spiritual protection that we need.
All right. Thank you. They can't be replaced by robots, though. I know that. You want to try one more,
nope.
Jimmy, or think that's enough?
Sure, real quick.
If you marry, Steve asks this, if you marry a changeling, at what point does her appearance become adultery?
Her appearance change.
Yeah.
Okay, so first thing is we're talking about Star Trek-like changelings that can change their appearance. In Earth folklore, a changeling cannot do that. But just because a changeling changes their appearance doesn't mean that it becomes adultery any more than when your wife dyes her hair another color, it becomes adultery. What would become adultery of the heart, though, is if you're thinking about your wife being someone else and imagining having relations with that person. That would be adultery of the heart, but it would not be adultery of the body or physical adultery even if the changeling changes appearances.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks to everybody who, and if you've got weird questions, you can send them to us at radio@catholic.com. We do our very best to get them to Jimmy, but Jimmy has all kinds of ways for you to get materials to him as well. Do check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World at mysterious.fm. New episodes each Friday. Thank you, Jimmy. Enjoyed the hours.
My pleasure.
All right, we'll see you next time. God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.